Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this week's Inspiring Leadership Podcast. I'm delighted to have Saul B. Hellman, a doctor who also is a board member and president of Epsom Life Sciences. And this whole area of health, well-being and sciences fascinates me. And we both, Saul and I, had a conversation through a mutual friend of ours, Alex Charity, some years ago. We worked out about 10 years ago. And the conversation that we had about leadership in general, I found so interesting that when I was thinking who you as the audience would enjoy listening to as an inspiring leader, I thought of Saul. And so reached out. He's a very private, very modest man, and he's not done podcasts before. So we're deeply honored to have him here. Saul, welcome to the Inspiring Leadership Podcast.
Thanks, Jonathan. Pleased to be here.
Yeah, well, look, it's great. And I think the first thing I'm always fascinated by is the journey that you've been on, your own journey, because you've got such an eclectic mix of all sorts of different experiences, which makes you very well suited for what you're doing now. Mm-hmm. But what was it that shaped you as the leader you are today? Your life experiences, your growing up, early childhood. Just take perhaps 10 minutes just to explain a bit about what shaped you.
Yeah, I think the primary kind of influence on who I am has been my parents and my upbringing. I think that is for most people, your first influence as you're growing up. And so a little bit of my history. I grew up in South Africa during the time of apartheid. My father and grandfather both passed now, but at the time were human rights lawyers in South Africa. So I grew up in that kind of environment where obviously human rights were at the core of the problems in the country. And my dad and my grandfather were very involved in trying to resolve that through the law, or resolve aspects of it through the law. And watching them work, listening to the issues that they were facing. My mom was a very active person in the movement as well, in terms of trying to bring change to the country. Seeing impacts on human beings and individuals and communities. I think that those were very influential in kind of who I am today and how I operate today. I'm obviously in a very different situation today. I'm living in the United States in Chicago, running my company and working with great people and in a completely different environment. But I think a lot of what I do today and a lot of what has led me to where I am today was shaped by those very early days in South Africa. One of the things in terms of my background is I've moved from clinical practice to operational management of healthcare companies and then completely left clinical practice, ran small companies, and then went into commercial marketing at a large pharmaceutical company, Eli Lilly and Company. And so, launched products around the world and then moved into consulting. So kind of very different career paths, very different experiences, and in very different countries, South Africa, United Kingdom, and the US. I guess part of that was me just searching for the right environment and finding the right place where, what makes me tick and what makes me get up in the morning will be fulfilled. And experimenting with different opportunities, different experiences, taking risks, I think those were all part of what I'd learned from my early days in South Africa.
No, I mean, what a incredible place and a time to be there. And I was just listening to Trevor Noah's book, Born a Crime is his right. book. And he said, my father was Swiss, white Swiss, and my mother was black. And he said, and therefore I was a crime. Absolutely. And so couldn't be seen with them together. Mum would walk on one side of the street, the dad on the other. And then when I tried to run after my dad, he'd run away because he didn't want to be seen with me. And I thought it was a game as I was chasing him. And so there was a comedian who really explained about what life was like. And I found it really eye-opening and quite a story. But yes, to have all that experience with father, grandfather on the human rights law side, it must make things interesting for you as you look at violations of human rights in different countries that you're in. How do you manage to cope with that when you find yourself having to operate with certain countries where you find it quite repulsive to operate, but you are trying to help people on a health side? Must be quite a dilemma that you have to face.
Yeah, it's not something that I generally face in my day-to-day work. It's something my clients face, I think, more than I do. And it is a dilemma in the context of one trying to keep in line with international laws, both local and global, but also trying to meet the needs of people. And the products that this industry, the life sciences industry, manufactures, are very impactful on people's health, and in a positive way, mostly. And it is difficult trying to manage that. My work is not in the import export sphere, so I don't actually get to touch that a lot. But my clients definitely do, and I have sat with boards of directors and executive committees who are having those conversations about international expansion, globalization, providing drugs, either life-saving drugs or life-altering drugs to countries that are on sanctions lists, and how, what are the processes around that, etc. Ironically, my son is actually doing that very work right now in his very first job, helping companies, including a life sciences company, with their import and export licenses to Russia for humanitarian use.
I think the whole area that you've worked in most of your life is a fascinating one. And other clients I've had on from places like Coca-Cola, then we get into the ultra-processed food side. And I think what's so very interesting is how can we move from, like in the UK, we have a national health service, but anyway, health service, which deals actually with sickness rather than health.
Yeah.
And moving more upstream, almost on the functional medicine side, where we look at the whole combination of things that make people ultimately sick, that they have to be looked after by the health service.
Right.
And I was listening to another doctor, Chris Van Tulleken, who does Ultra Processed People, was his latest book. And he was saying this whole thing of companies like Nestle sending a boat up the Amazon to places that had never had ultra processed food. Suddenly, within 2 years, the stops along the way who buy the food end up obese, and they never were before when they're eating their other. So how do we understand the sort of capitalist system of big pharma, big ultra processed foods like Kraft and Nestle and on the others, who need to make a profit from it? But at the same time, we really do need to look after this viral epidemic of obesity, where people are so addicted to certain foods, but then we give them a pill to make up for the fact that they've got addicted to ultra processed food. I don't know. It's a big topic, but I wonder if you had a view.
It's a huge topic. And I think it's something that, the World Health Organization struggles with at a macro level. And certainly in the United States, a lot of our healthcare issues are because of what we eat and how we don't exercise, fundamentally how we treat our bodies. And often it's not through choice. It's because of the system, as you say, in terms of either processed foods or not having access to fresh foods, poverty. These are all socioeconomic issues that kind of drive, unfortunately, a system where we ultimately treat and don't prevent. Prevention is expensive and a long-term game. And expense and long-term don't necessarily jive with capitalism. So I think we're always going to have that conundrum of trying to manage a long-term need while reaping short-term profits and shareholder satisfaction. So I think that conundrum is going to continue to drive this. There are companies that I think are taking social responsibility a lot more seriously, and I think that is having some positive impact. But we're trying to feed billions and billions of people around the world, often in environments that are not conducive to fresh food. So it's a challenge. I mean, it's just a massive challenge. And I think that conundrum of time period and return on investment will always be there.
Yes, and you're in America, I'm in the UK. We're two of the countries with some of the biggest obesity problems. I think, is it 40% of Americans are obese? Yeah. And then another 20% are overweight. You know, it wasn't that way 20 years ago. So what's gone on? What's changed so much? And I think if we can have somehow that capitalist organizations make money from something, but at the same time, we look at making people healthier rather than trying to fix them when we've made them addicted to an ultra processed food, which we then somebody else can give them a pill to try and make them better. Or was it Ozempic or something like that people are trying to take now, and they lose their appetite. They go, oh, this will solve it. No, they're still eating the ultra processed food. It's just, it has some side effects. So everything has a spin-off, doesn't it, really?
Yeah, absolutely. It kind of cause and effect. And then, you know, you go down the line, and as people get older, you know, you're taking more drugs, you're taking drugs to counter side effects of other drugs. So polypharmacy becomes an issue, and the cost of healthcare continues to go up. So it is a conundrum. I don't know that there's one solution. And also one cause. I think it's a multifactorial thing that, again, I think some companies are trying to deal with. Unfortunately, a lot of what we do in life sciences is very much treatment focused, not prevention. And some of that's because of the regulatory structure. You know, to get a drug for prevention is a much higher hurdle than to get a drug for treatment. So, you know, when you're on a limited patent and limited time frame, you know, trying to get a drug into market for prevention can take a lot longer and cost a lot more than it would for treatments. And so you know, even the regulatory structure works against us. So in that context, so yeah, I think it's a challenge. I mean, it's one that does bother me. It's bothered me, you know, when I was a physician. Certainly one of the reasons why I left clinical practice was I had a sense of not quite failure, but like just defeated, you know, in terms of I'm just treating problems that shouldn't even be here in the first place. And then many of the population are not necessarily adherent to their treatment, whether it's because they don't care about it or the system doesn't make it convenient to get your treatment, you know, whether you've got access to drugs or et cetera. You become defeated in a way in terms of even your healthcare delivery, you know, type thing. Mm-hmm. One of many reasons why I left clinical practice, but it is a challenge.
Yeah, no, it definitely isn't. And I you know, I'm on a bit of a fitness drive, and so is my wife, and we've got four children, all married, and they're beginning to go on a fitness drive in what we eat and how we train. But there's no doubt about it that you can't outrun a bad diet, you know. So what we put into our bodies is going to have a huge impact on us. But it is sad, a bit like the military industrial complex that Eisenhower talked about. That it all seems to sort of feed this machine that likes to keep having wars. And I know you and I talked about pacifism, and I was brought up by a Quaker grandmother and a whole Quaker ethos of not war fighting. In the same way, I feel we've got this ultra-processed pharmaceutical complex, which it seems to sort of like, you make them all really ill and we'll give them some pills and then we'll both make lots of money. But let's not cure this. Let's not sell broccoli to them. This would be terrible. We wouldn't want that. You know, there's no additives in that. There's no money in that, really. But do you think we'll ever sort of break the cycle that we've got into, where even the system is set up to reward treating an illness rather than going upstream and preventing it in the first place, which would actually ultimately save the whole country billions? Yeah. But it isn't encouraged by people who are in this revolving door of being in an industry, regulating it, then going to make some money working for the big pharma or the big ultra processed food companies. But are we ever going to break this sort of cycle?
I don't know. It is a challenge, and I think, you know, for something like that to break, it's going to take a seismic event in a way. And I don't know. I don't know if we're ready for that as humanity. You know, there are other bigger problems that we're facing as humanity on Earth, mm-hmm. right? So, climate change being one, wars and mm-hmm. conflict being another. Healthcare being another, education being another. I mean, there are massive problems around the world that we've got to deal with. And, you know, the systems, and certainly the healthcare systems that I've worked in South Africa, in the UK, and in the States, and I've obviously had exposure to the rest of the world through my commercial experience in pharmaceuticals. All of these systems are so entrenched in a way and so relied upon and in many cases revered. You look at the NHS in the UK, it's celebrated. Here in the States, perhaps not so much celebrated, other than for perhaps the ingenuity of our healthcare system and the technology that gets developed. But all of these systems are so entrenched, and then layers and layers upon that over the years through legal intervention, through passing laws, passing regulations, etc. It would take a lot to break these systems, I think. So I don't know if that's going to be the answer. I think the answer is to continue to legislate and regulate through the system you're in, no matter which country you're in. Try and learn from the best of every country, because every country's got something unique that is good. And try and bring in some of those collective learnings. No country, I think, has got healthcare, for example, perfect. I think it's a challenge. And unfortunately, healthcare happens, right? Because we're getting older, we're exposed to the elements, whether it's food, whether it's the sun, whether it's chemicals. Our genetic makeup is fragile, so we deteriorate as animals, as organic animals, and so we're going to get sick. We're going to have problems. So healthcare is an unfortunate need, and an expensive need, and a continuous need. And right now, we're going through the aging population, with the largest, oldest population that the world has experienced. I think I can't remember the study, but somewhere I read the last 2 years of life are the most expensive from a healthcare point of view, and that's somewhat obvious in the context of what happens to us, right, as we get older.
No doubt about it. That I aspire to have my health span match my lifespan, so that I'm, you know, healthy until the end, and then keel over. Rather than, as I've seen with too many people I know, that the last 10 years of their lives are multiple comorbidities that they are suffering from.
Yeah.
But in your fascinating days, I'd love to hear about your fascinating days as a doctor and what you did learn, which has served you now in Epsilon Life Sciences. And then would you also tell us a bit about what Epsilon Life Sciences does now? Because it's clearly your company, but I'd just love to hear a bit about it.
Yeah, absolutely. So you know, kind of growing up in business as a physician, I have always found very helpful, and people often ask me, don't you miss it? And what, you know, wasn't it a waste doing medicine and practicing and then not doing it and going into business? I don't think it was at all. I learned a fortune as a physician, just fundamentally in human interaction and helping people through some of their most distressed periods in life. I've dealt with death. I've dealt with disease. I've dealt with challenge, people in challenge and overcoming challenges from a healthcare point of view. I've also learned systems thinking, you know, in terms of diagnosing a disease or evaluating treatment pathways. All of that is systems based, where you're looking at various elements that may factor into what the outcome might look like. And so, the interpersonal skills, the systems way of thinking, I think have been two cornerstones in my success personally, both from a just personal success, but also the success around me in the context of the people I work with, people I've worked for and the people who work for me. So, you know, I think just at a very high level, those are two things. But there's not a day that doesn't go by where I reflect back on something I learned from being a doctor and delivering healthcare and working in healthcare systems that I don't apply today, you know, 30 years later. So I think it was very instrumental in kind of who I am and how I operate. Let me shift to Epsilon just quickly. I'm very proud of Epsilon. Epsilon Life Sciences was set up coming up on 3 years ago in partnership with a colleague of mine, Dr. Mohan Rao, who's a PhD economist. I had worked with him in a previous company where he led the economics practice. He branched out, I want to say 8 or 9 years ago, and set up Epsilon Economics, which is our sister company. And after 6 years, gave me a call and said, let's set up life sciences together. And I took the opportunity, and my team was formed largely out of the team that I had created some 13 years prior. And so Mohan and I, together with two other colleagues, set up life sciences, and have been going for almost 3 years now. The core of what we do is working with life sciences companies, so the manufacturers in the healthcare continuum, and really helping those companies either stay out of trouble, get out of trouble, or mitigate the trouble that they're in. And more specifically, the areas that we focus in on are areas of what is kind of referred to as healthcare compliance. So compliance with the laws as it relates to the promotion of products and from a commercial point of view, but also the management of products and healthcare professionals, interactions with healthcare professionals that companies have in support of their products in the market. So kind of, again, at a very high level, anything that involves a transfer of value between a life sciences company and a healthcare professional or a healthcare organization is relevant, or anything that involves a transfer of data is relevant. A lot of what we work with is off-label promotion and kickbacks or bribes, where the government asserts that a company has engaged in that behavior, investigates the company, reaches a settlement, and then has some oversight of the company following the settlement. We're involved in that entire continuum with outside counsel and with the companies themselves. The other area that we focus on is on the privacy side, obviously a very big issue in the UK and Europe. The US is catching up with various states enacting privacy laws. And so again, we help companies with the privacy side of their work. Life sciences companies are starting to interact more and more with patients as therapies become more specified in terms of, you know, specific patient care. Pharmacogenomics is providing a lot of individualized treatments. So apart from manufacturing, these companies are actually getting very involved in patient care. Medical devices have been involved in patient care, so exposure to patient information and the privacy associated with that, a very big issue.
Fantastic. Well, it's a huge amount that you're doing there. And as you say, there's so many occasions when these companies can get into terrible trouble, but the experience that you and your team have got clearly will help them. And really that takes me on to one of the things that we had that particular bond on when we were chatting, is just your fascination with the whole topic of leadership. You know, how difficult it is to lead anything, any organization. Where have you gathered over the years your learning and your understanding and your practice of inspiring leadership? Because people do say you're an inspiring leader. You know, this is not just you voted yourself an inspiring leader. I've heard of others who talk about this of you, and they respect you. So where did you learn about it? What is your sort of viewpoint on leadership? You know, I'd love to hear a bit on that.
It's interesting. One of the leaders that I've admired quite naturally in a way is Nelson Mandela, and how he managed through his life, largely under the thumb of an apartheid government in South Africa, and then emerging as the first president of a democratic South Africa. I had the privilege of meeting with him. My family have a relationship with him. He was article clerk to my grandfather when he was studying law.
Wow.
So I not only had the opportunity to read his books and read books about him, but I had the opportunity to speak to Madiba and learn from him. And you know, one of the things that he talks about is leading from behind. He uses the shepherd as an example, and he was a shepherd as a kid. Using that kind of analogy of leading from behind and bringing people forward and creating opportunity for people to exceed beyond their own expectations. And that is something that I've always held. You know, I held that in my clinical practice, trying to get patients to believe that they can get beyond where they are and believe in one, taking the therapy, whatever therapy it was, but also in doing the right thing, starting to build in some of that preventative kind of stuff that we talked about earlier, but really helping patients take ownership of their management. Likewise, in leadership, one of the things that I've always tried to do is create an environment where people take ownership for their careers. And I facilitate and create the environment where people can develop, grow, challenge, be tested, fail, learn, grow, and move forward. And so that's probably one of the more influential leaders that I've learned from, but also has impacted the way I operate. There's a book that I read early on in my MBA days, Maverick by Ricardo Semler.
Yeah, love it. I love it.
And his approach was really turning things upside down. And I love that concept of turning things upside down from the tradition. And I've tried to do that on occasion myself, sometimes with success, sometimes not, because the system doesn't allow for that. But I've also tried to be a little bit of a maverick occasionally as well. You know, one of the things that I'm really proud about with Epsilon is that everybody in the company is a shareholder. And so we have a collective ownership here, and we will have a collective benefit as we continue to grow. And so that's just another kind of influence as well as I've moved along.
Yeah, no, I love that. And so let's take it from your learning and your practice of leadership to some of your life experiences. We have good times and we have difficult times. I think I've learned more from my mistakes, as someone once said. Mm-hmm. I learned so much from my mistakes, I think I'm going to go and make a few more. But on a more poignant note, a dark moment in your life, and what did it teach you, Saul?
Yeah, that's a challenging question, actually. I think more broadly, the concept of learning from mistakes or learning from failure is really important. And that's something I learned very early on, again, in my clinical practice. You learn very quickly through failure there. And you value those opportunities of learning, hopefully not at the cost of somebody else, but that opportunity to learn is critically important. So I've carried that along and tried to instill that in terms of, you know, failure is an opportunity for learning. It's not something that we should be angry about or dismissive about. It should be something we embrace and learn from. You know, in terms of dark moments, I don't really think of them as dark moments. That's the thing. Probably in my tenure at Eli Lilly and Company, for example, which is a fabulous company, and I had a wonderful time there, learned a fortune. But it was a company under significant stress. They'd lost a patent on their biggest product, and within a month lost a third of its revenue. So the company was under a huge amount of distress. And obviously, as a result of that, they had to do some what they call reallocations, where people's jobs go away and then you have to find another job in the company. And that happened to me within literally months of joining the company. and changing my career. So that was probably what you would call a dark moment, where I had two very young kids, a wife, two dogs, and the potential of no job. My job was reallocated. And there were options to exit favorably. Lily, I think, did a really good job, certainly for an American company, did a very good job of taking care of people. But that's not what I wanted to do. I was trying to learn a new industry. I was trying to understand the career of marketing and global marketing and strategy, and implement what I'd learned at MBA, at my MBA, and what I'd learned through running smaller companies. I didn't want that to happen. And so I could have taken the easy path and taken a package, and which would have given me a good year to find another opportunity, or fight for a job. And I decided to fight for a job. And that reallocation process happened to me 3 times in 5 years. And each time I ended up being promoted and finding another fabulous job. But it was that kind of decision point of what do you do, and what do you choose to do?
Yeah.
That I think was somewhat pivotal.
Yeah, and I seem to remember when we were discussing in our chat earlier before the podcast, you also learned from toxic leadership. I think you had a toxic leader you worked for.
Yeah.
What was your learning from that situation?
Yeah, that was one of my earliest kind of business experiences while still practicing medicine. And the individual involved really did a lot of things to individuals and to the company that I learned very quickly I would never do. one talks about toxic leaders, things like a degree of micromanagement that did not allow you to actually contribute, right? So you become very almost negative very quickly. You can become very negative in the context of your job, your role, and your ability. The second guessing, elements of fraud, the shouting, the bringing people down in public situations, things like that were going on that really, one, distressed me. And again, I could have made a choice to just leave, but I decided rather to stay and work with it. And things improved over time, but never really improved to where I wanted it to be. But there were huge learnings out of that. There were learnings just for myself as to what I was going to be and do as a leader going forward. But there were also learnings on how to help others manage that as well. And that was one of the things that I learned very quickly. It was helping others with that scenario and that situation.
Yeah, well, no, I think I've also worked for toxic leaders, and you certainly learn, well, I'm certainly not going to do that. But also, what do you do to avoid condoning? Because if you don't know anything about it, in some ways you're condoning the behavior, and, putting up with it when you see people being treated badly, it really does challenge us. But taking yourself back to, growing up in South Africa, I'm not sure what age you were when you left there, but, thinking back to, if you went back to meet Saul, age 16 to 18, what advice would you give to a young person at that age, with the wisdom you've learned now of all the mistakes that you and I have made, that might be useful? You got your own two children of your own, but what advice would you give?
Yeah, I think one of the things that I have learned and try and instill in others is that every experience is a learning experience, and every experience is a positive experience if you learn from it. So, don't be afraid of diversity in what you do. Don't be afraid of wanting to do something different. When I made my choices to change careers as many times as I did, there was always an element of fear associated with that, because there was a degree of going from known to unknown. I would say to myself, don't be as fearful as you were at the time, because you would have probably gained a lot quicker than you did, in terms of the new experience. So that kind of diversity is not a bad thing. And certainly, as I look at the millennials and Gen Z now, looking to change jobs as often as they do, I embrace it. I think that that's a wonderful thing because it is creating a lot of diversity and broad skill sets that we're going to need in the future. And one of the other things that I learned as a physician, whenever we had a code, when you're a young physician, your immediate reaction is to run, like you see on TV, in the various medical programs, run to the code, run to the patient who's dying. And a professor stopped us, literally stopped us in our tracks and said, this is not, you don't run. You walk carefully and you make sure you get there safely. Most people are not going to die because you don't get there quick enough. They're going to die from other reasons. And most of the time, people aren't actually going to die when there's an emergency. So every emergency doesn't lead to a death. And so I constantly remind myself when something happens around me in work, nobody's going to die from this. So take a breath, get your composure, understand the context of what's going on, and then jump in. But really take that breath and pause.
Wow. And
in my early days, I was very keen to run. Right?
Yeah. No, you've made me smile because I remember a friend of mine, Alistair, who was very languid and very laid back. And I said, Alistair, I'm just going for a run. It was in Cyprus up Mount Trudos. And I was doing one of my training sessions. I said, I'm just going for a run. Do you want to join me? And he looked at me and he went, Jonathan, leaders don't run. It panics the men. but it's a very fair point that many leaders I've worked for about, you know, when the pressure's on, you do need to remain really calm and think well. And if you're in a flurry of a frenzy of anxiety, you come in and you make the wrong decisions and you don't think well. And I've seen that all too often in leadership situations where people get caught up in the frenzy of activity and the urgency of the moment rather than what is the right thing to do. And talking about doing the right thing, it takes me on to, I just want to take you around the Inspiring Leadership Compass and just briefly touch on some of your own viewpoints on these important areas and what makes high performing, inspiring leaders. But moral quotient, integrity, values, beliefs, you've touched on this already with, you know, the toxic leader doing exactly the opposite. Your father, your grandfather, your mother, their values. I mean, deeply respect that you knew Nelson Mandela and met him, and you know the link with as article clerk to your grandfather, so special. What's your tip about values and how leaders show up and display their values?
So I think, you know, and I can't remember the author, True North, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Bill George. Bill George.
Bill George. The concept of that, I think, is really important, is following your true north. Now, how do you find your true north? I think, again, a lot of that comes with upbringing and, you know, your early environmental experiences. But I think following some form of moral compass is really important, no matter where you get it from. And then sticking to your values and being very clear about your values up front. It's one of the things we did at Epsilon when we set up Epsilon Life Sciences. We established our operating principles and values before we established anything else because we wanted to make sure we were all operating with each other, with our clients, and with any other key stakeholders the way we wanted to. Again, I think it was some of my early experiences in terms of humanity and how human beings treat each other, positive and negative, that helped frame my moral compass. And it's no coincidence that, you know, I think my career has ended up in compliance, where ethics, integrity, and compliance are tightly interwoven in terms of how my clients operate. And hopefully how I'm helping my clients. I think it's getting those early experiences, bringing them into your true north, and then sticking to that. Obviously learning as you grow, but really following that your moral code.
Mm. No, I think that's beautifully put. This idea that Bill George and others have said, we use the inspiring leadership compass with MQ at the top, with the true north pointing towards it. That's no accident. It's deliberately built around that. And to the right and to the left is meaning and purpose, MQ. MQ at the top, PQ, the meaning and purpose, and LQ, legacy. But if we just talk about meaning and purpose, PQ, you've done all these different jobs, but there's a theme running through them, which is obviously your values that you brought up, whether it be from parents, grandfather, Mandela, and others you've met. But what gives your life meaning and purpose, and how would you help others who are a bit lost and don't really have a sense of meaning and purpose? Because it's linked to their health. I mean, if we come back to your health again, you know, people who have a good sense of meaning and purpose live healthier, longer lives.
I've actually done this exercise with my team on a number of occasions where we literally will sit and chat about why do we get out of bed in the morning and come to work, whether it's physically in the office or remotely or at a client site. Why do we even do that? You know, what's driving us? And challenging us to think about that. And sometimes the reasoning might be very, you know, minuscule in other people's minds. Sometimes it might be a very deep, meaningful, humanistic, you know, purpose. There might be some philosophy behind it. But I think it is an important question to challenge all of ourselves with. I think, you know, for me, as I've thought about it, one of the reasons for being is for my family. That kind of ties into the legacy. My kids are my legacy, and that's a huge driver. So a lot of what I do is to help support the family, both, you know, emotionally, physically, financially, etc. That's my primary objective. But within the work that I do, in terms of the purpose, you know, one of the themes that runs through all of it is healthcare, and you know, again, helping create an environment where people can get out of a state of dis-ease. I use that word purposefully. And so whether that's a client, a patient, an employee, a colleague, a friend, that's a common theme for me, is try and create an environment where we can get out of a state of dis-ease.
Yeah, I do like that expression, dis-ease. It really is to get people from dis-ease to ease. I really love that one, which takes me nicely onto health quotient, which is in all the leadership models that you and I have studied over the years. Few of them have one of the eight elements as health and well-being, and we found it so key, linked with resilience, which we'll come to later. But what is your tip about mental and physical health and what you're doing at your stage in life? But what would be your tip on both those?
That's probably another thing I'd say to my 16-year-old self, is think about that early. Don't wait too long. I unfortunately waited too long on that and had a period of dis-ease where I was not healthy. I've taken care of that now. I've sought medical attention, but also you know, I've invested in a personal trainer who's done a great job with me over the last few years, right through COVID, etc. And I work out 3 to 4 times a week with my trainer. That's been a huge component, just physically being active and physically, you know, challenging myself. Very important. I'm still working on the food part, as I think many of us are. That is a challenge. Even in the privileged society that I live in, it's a challenge to get healthy food and to enjoy it at the same time. I do enjoy my food, so I'm still a work in progress on that. But and then on the mental health side, I think mental disease is prevalent throughout our society, and our ability to manage is constantly challenged. So mental health is something that I think is really common, and something that we individually should be looking out for of ourselves, and not be shy of seeking help. I've had to in the past, when my father passed, when my mom passed, I went through stages of depression and sought mental health. And thankfully I did. I was better for it, and the people around me were better for it. But I think recognizing that early is important. So yeah, this is definitely a message that I came to late in my leadership journey, and one that I encourage young leaders to get to early.
Yeah. Firstly, I'm sorry that you went through the that period of depression. I have been through depression myself, and been in a bad place for a couple of years, and got through it. But coming out of the other side of it, and finding the practices that will help keep good mental health is key. And as you say, I found the biggest thing is we are what we eat. And I've got this great personal trainer, Adam Northover, who trains me. And as I think it said, his wife, Naomi, trains my wife, and about to start training our daughter. And then Adam trains our son. And I have found in the last 7 weeks that I've been on this program, it's an app, and I follow the food I have, and he gives me feedback, and he reads what I've done, and we measure various things from weight above the tummy button, below size of legs, arms, this kind of stuff, chest. And I found the discipline of following a healthy macronutrient-based diet with good protein to help with the muscle building as well as the weight loss has really, really helped. I've lost, you know, 8 pounds in 7 weeks. Not a lot, but for me, yeah, quite a lot, because I'm a pretty steady kind of weight. And I found that helps my mental health. And as you found with your personal trainer, I've certainly found training 3 times a week on my own, but following a set on the app, certain set exercises right. that I have with videos of what to do, so I know the form and the structure's right. And then having a personal trainer come to, we've converted the garage into a gym, to the gym. But we are lucky to be able to do that and to afford. And really this touches back on the point you made that health is a income related problem. There's the two halves, the haves and the have nots. And whether you're in a food desert in America and all you can get is junk food, or what you can afford, or your, what's the system called in America for the people who are poorer, that they get certain help financially with food stuff they can buy. What's it called? It's like,
I'm trying to remember the name of it.
But the problem is much of it is provided by the likes of Coca-Cola and Pepsi and the like, and they're all highly addictive ultra processed food, which makes their problem even bigger. So being able to have a choice on the healthy foods you eat is key. EQ, emotional intelligence, is something that the next element around. As a doctor, you know it when you're with a doctor who is interested, cares about you, believes in you getting better, and the way they treat you has a massive impact. I'm reading a book called The Expectation Effect.
Yeah,
and there's no doubt about it. If you get a good GP, who is positive and able to help you think about it and ways to get better, you improve a lot. But sometimes too many in the health system are very bright, but their interpersonal skills are not that good. What's your tip to help those who are listening who haven't yet developed the language of emotional intelligence and social intelligence? What would you advise them?
Yeah, all very important points. And I think not only the expectation concept, but I think the action concept as well. The act of going to a GP in itself gives you power, right? So you have power to get better. I think one of the things I was told again early on in my career with patient interaction is I have 2 ears, 1 mouth, and so use them in that proportion. Listen twice as much as you speak, and I still have to remind myself to do that on occasion, because I do like to talk, but I think it's really important to listen, because the more you listen and really hear what an individual is saying to you, the more you're able to actually give something of value back through that interaction. Mm-hmm. Even if it's something you're trying to get somebody to do, for example, in a work situation, listen to where they're coming from And then you can shape what you need in the context of what's going to give them satisfaction or give them an experience that will help them. But it's really, I think, truly listening helps drive that understanding, which then I think weighs into that entire kind of emotional connection that you would have with an individual.
Fantastic. Next one round is CQ, or what I call collaborative cognitive and cultural intelligence. Diversity, equality, inclusion, it's very much at the heart, soul of who you are, what you stand for, and the upbringing you had from your family. But what's your advice to people on how should they get on with people who are very different from them?
Difference is an opportunity to learn. And again, I think one of the things that successful people reflect is this constant thirst for learning. And so I would encourage people to look for differences and then learn from them. You know, one of the things that we've done with our team here, we've got a very small team, but when I look at each individual and what they bring, both personally, culturally, academically, skill set wise, etc., it's a highly diverse team. And I think it's one of the bedrocks to our success, because whenever we're in front of a client with members of our team, they're seeing that diversity at play, and they're seeing that diversity of experience, diversity of thought, diversity of expertise come into their solutions. And I think that is a huge advantage, it's a competitive advantage. But I think just personally, I've always found it very satisfying learning from people that are different from me, because you learn different perspectives, you learn different ways of doing things, you learn different ways of reacting to things. And it can make the whole better if you bring in these diverse opportunities, ideas.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And this is why when my wife and I fly to the UAE tomorrow for the Ride for Unity, it's about diversity, equality, inclusion, acceptance of people who are different from us, and whether they're from Iran or Egypt or the Emirates or Israel or wherever people may be from, America, Britain, all over the place. It's lovely having those different riders together, and they bring this melting pot of experiences, which you can only benefit from. You've been through a lot in your life, and as you say, as a doctor, you saw death and disease, and you've worked for good bosses and bad bosses, and you've moved from job to job, and in the days in Eli Lilly when the mass restructuring and people being laid off, you need to pick yourself up in those times of adversity. What's your tip to people listening who are perhaps going through their own adversity now? What is your top tip?
I think it goes back to purpose. For me, it was always the family. When I was younger, it was family, both older generation and younger generation. Now I'm the senior in the family. But it goes back to family. For me, that's my primary purpose. And so my reaction to any adversity is reset in that context. Okay, here's what I need to do. Here's what I'm going to choose to do. Here's how I'm going to operate. Here's how I'm going to react. I frame it all in the context of that. That's probably the main thing, is go back to purpose. And then follow your moral compass, right? Don't deviate, because as soon as you deviate, you let yourself down, and then you let people around you down.
Yeah, that's lovely. The other one with your days in marketing is the whole area of BQ, brand, reputation, image, and impact. Clearly, you were trained up in companies' brand, reputation, image, and impact. But what's your advice to people to manage their own brand and learn about how they're experienced by other people?
It's all about brand. I'm a huge advocate behind brand development and brand maintenance. I used to do a thing, and actually I should probably, now that I'm talking about it, probably bring it back. I used to help folks in the early parts of their career develop their brand map, as if they were a product, right? What is the brand you want to create? So kind of what is the image you want to convey to people about you? What is your source of authority? What is what are the elements of your brand that you want to make sure stick out? And then in all of your actions, your behaviors, your interactions, your deliverables, you need to reflect that and keep coming back to the brand that you want to be. It can be very structured like that, creating a brand map, et cetera. But I think fundamentally, it's just recognizing that, you know, every interaction you have, every transfer of your information is a reflection of your brand. And people will see your brand not necessarily the way you want them to. So you've got to understand who's looking at your brand at the same time. So you've got to take time to understand who you're interacting with and able to convey your brand in a way that's going to land appropriately with that individual. In marketing, you know, that was in Lilly, it was patient segmentation, it was healthcare professional segmentation, understanding the different types of people out there and creating the brand around that.
Yeah, I love it. Well, thank you for that. Great, great tip. It's all about brand, as you say. But also it's about the legacy that we leave, either in our lunchtime or in our lifetime, what impact we make on people. What would you like your legacy to be, and how should people think about their own legacy?
It's interesting. I haven't really been that bothered with my legacy as I've gone through my life, other than my kids. That, to me, that is my legacy. And so that's my very tangible legacy. They're hopefully a reflection of me as they grow up. But if I do, and you challenged me when we were last chatting about this, if I do think about my legacy, I think one of the things that I would like to be remembered for ultimately is someone who helped create an opportunity where others or individuals are able to exceed their own expectations or their own limitations or their own perception of their limitations. And so really just creating environments where people are successful, including myself, but from a legacy point of view, others around me have that thought, I guess. That would probably be...
That's a nice one. Yeah, I like it. Last couple of questions, executive team's favorite book, and then we'll do the 2-minute top tip. Executive teams, we've talked about toxic teams. We talked about toxic individuals rather, but what's your top tip to people listening about what do they do when they've got a toxic team?
Yeah, so when there is, let's say an individual, a toxic individual in the organization, I have one of two approaches. One is to treat that infection with an antibiotic. And in the case of the business world, that antibiotic might be coaching, it might be counseling, it might be creating different environments to work in to be successful and hopefully be less toxic. So treat the infection. The other is cut it out. take the surgical approach. The surgical approach, though, I think is often relied on perhaps too often by people, and they don't take the time to try and understand where the individual is coming from in terms of being toxic. Because you know, most people show up at work trying to do the best they can. Very few of us get up out of bed and go, you know, I'm really going to screw up today. I want to make a mess of this. Most people are trying to do the best they can. So if you work on the infection through treatment, often you end up with a much better situation. But eventually there's a point where surgery has to intervene.
Very, very wisely put. Favorite book. What would your favorite book be, Saul, that you'd recommend on leadership that people should read, a good read?
I do think Maverick was a great book and probably the most impactful for me in terms of moving into business from clinical, and which was one of the first business books I read. It still sits on my shelf. I still look at it occasionally. I'm not a big reader. I do have dyslexia, so I find it tough to read. It's a chore. But that is probably the one that I'd encourage people to read, just to challenge and to think about things in an upside down world. You know.
As a fellow dyslexic, I'm delighted to find that you are too, and to have had such a successful career in spite of our superpower, as we can rephrase it. But I tend to listen to a massive number of audiobooks. That's my way around. Okay, so Saul, if you just now just say who you are, introduce the role that you have in your company, and give us your 2-minute top leadership tip, and that will end us nicely.
Yeah, so Saul Hellman, I'm the president of Epsilon Life Sciences, my top tip is probably, recognize that most times nobody's going to die. The problem isn't that big. Take the time to reflect, take the time to understand the context, take the time to recognize that most people around you are showing up to do the best they can, and then figure out how to handle the problem from there. That's probably the main tip. The second tip would be get healthy and stay healthy as early as you can in your career.
I love that one. Get and stay healthy. Saul, I knew it was going to be a lot of fun, and we were going to range across a whole load of topics. And thank you. We had a bit of a structure, but quite frankly, you went with whatever we decided to talk about. And I find it so very interesting. So on behalf of all the listeners and myself, thank you for being on the Inspiring Leadership Podcast.
It's a pleasure. And I've really enjoyed watching these podcasts over the last few years since we first met, and seeing the development of it and the great library that you have. I'm working through some of it, right? So really enjoying it. And hope this has been helpful to somebody.
It definitely has. Thank you very much indeed, Saul.
Great.